Welcome back. So when we start to look at step one, as I said before, as we look at step one from three perspectives, the physical craving, the mental obsession, and the unmanageability. So we're going to start talking about the physical craving first. You know, the book's set up kind of in an interesting way, where we look at the physical craving was from the doctor's opinion up to the top of 23. But what we'll see is that at the end of each section there'll be a summary, and it's good to know where we're headed. So we basically know what we're supposed to see here. At the end of each session, there'll be a summary of what we should have seen. At the beginning of each session, there'll be a summary of what we're going to see, or a review of what we've seen to this point. So you'll understand in a second here. And this is the summary of the physical part of the problem. On the bottom of 22 to the top of 23, it says, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, that makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. So the consideration here is, does my experience abundantly confirm that once I take any alcohol into my system, something happens, and I lose control of how much I drink? Okay. And in order to look at that, to come to that conclusion, we start with the doctor's opinion. On page XXIV, the doctor makes this statement. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. So what would physical alcoholic torture look like? XXVI.
Fourth edition.
Fourth edition. I'm in the third edition. I must have a third edition book here, too. XXVI in the fourth edition. Thank you. What does alcoholic torture look like, but from the physical perspective? Right. For me, the feeling of running out, right? you know, knowing that I don't have enough to finish up to make it through the night, right? And what I found that many times, in order to avoid that place, I would go out and make sure that I stocked up before my wife came home, because it was much harder to sneak out and buy more booze than to, you know, to make sure I had enough in the house, because there's nothing worse than running out of alcohol and needing to continue to drink.
Right. I had, as I said, I was living on the streets at the end, and you know, the bars, and they stopped selling alcohol at 2 a.m. For me, it was stealing alcohol before 2 a.m. I had no money, so the torture of that was that, how am I going to get a drink? You know, it wasn't about having any stashed away or anything. I continuously drank all night, and I would go in the store and I would drink vanilla. Vanilla has 35% alcohol by volume. Shoot down a couple of those and get some NyQuil. Drink a couple of bottles of that. Back in the day, they had 25% by volume. Drink a whole bottle of that. And that was torturous. I remember that as my alcoholic torture. But I think the main thing is once I start, I couldn't stop, is what we look at in the first step.
goes on to say that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. One of the things about physical cravings is I see a lot of people trying to intellectualize it. How does the physical craving feel? Remember, Bill and Bob didn't know anything about the physical craving until Dr. Silkworth explained the concept to him. With some drugs, it's easy to feel it. With alcohol, it was a little bit more concealed until the end of my drink. But near when things seemed to be working, what I see more is that I didn't necessarily. I mean, I certainly felt the physical craving. As I said, near the end of my drinking, but in the middle of all the drinking, it was more of what I saw is the lack of control, the lack of control that I see in my life. Listen to what it says. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life. I certainly believed I was maladjusted to life. This is that we were in full flight from reality. Looking back, I see I was in full flight of reality, from reality. Or we were outright mental defectives. I didn't like that statement, but when I look back at the way that I was living, you know. But see, it says these things were true to some extent, in fact to a considerable extent with some of us. It certainly was there with me. But look at what those are. Those are mental states, right? Maladjusted to life, full of flight from reality, outright mental defective, right? It says, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief that any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. So for the physical craving, what I have to do is set aside my mental idea of what the craving looks like and look at what is happening in the physical sense, in my body. So it goes on to say the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So how does this interest me? As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But for the ex-problem drinker, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. So, I've heard people say, you know, I'm sitting in the meeting and I've had a craving to drink. And as Dan was talking about, that's a mental thing. A craving only occurs, and this is what Dr. Silkworth came to the conclusion, that a craving only occurs once the substance has entered the body. That's when the craving occurs. So my mind basically gets me to the first drink, and therefore the craving occurs. They have a study this a lot, and they found that there is a genome that is the alcoholic genome, and what it looks like, and this really, you know, just kind of gives an idea of what the physical craving, how it occurs. So we take a drink, we have insufficient amount of enzymes of quantity and quality, and those enzymes, it breaks down the foods and everything that we drink, it breaks it down. But when it comes to the alcoholic, he retains the alcohol, and the enzymes become like a sponge and starts to absorb it. And what happens is that it goes through this whole chemical process down to an acetone level. And once it gets to that acetone level, that's when the craving occurs. And that happens very quickly, actually. And I'm thinking about the second drink while I'm having the first. And I'm thinking about the third while I'm having the second, and on and on. So the theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. So that's how I got interested in that idea, that scientific stuff. You know, it just kind of makes sense, you know, but it kind of gives it some validity.
I'm allergic to grass. Right?
What kind of grass?
just regular old grass.
Oh, okay.
when I sit in grass, I start to itch. Right? Doesn't matter what's going on in my mind. What's happening is that when I think back at the last time I sat in grass, right, I could see that what happened was that I'd start to scratch, right? I don't always break out in a rash or anything. I'm scratching already. But remember, that's the mental part of it. That's not, it's nothing to do with it, right? But the actual physical reaction of me sitting in grass is I break out in an itch. As with alcohol, when I start to put alcohol in my system, I break out in a craving for more. And it's got nothing to do with what I'm thinking, right? It's got to do with what I see. I see that I break out in an itch. And what it looks like for me is, the book doesn't go real deep into explaining what an allergy is. It just says that the theory of this being an allergy interests us. What it does talk about is story after story about, illustration after illustration of what it looks like to live a life of lack of control. Right. So looking back, I see that when I look at my business that died of alcoholism, I look at what's around it and I see that if I didn't drink the way I was drinking, the consequences of that drinking wouldn't have affected the business. Right. So although during the time I wasn't aware of it necessarily of the idea of a physical craving, right, I did see that if I was just going out and drinking one drink a night, that wouldn't have hurt me. The fact is that I go out and get a drink during lunch, and then that was it. I wouldn't make it. I either wouldn't make it back to work, or I happen to own the business, so I could get away with it.
Sort of
get away with it. I didn't get away with it because it ran it to the ground. You know, same thing with the marriage. I look back, and if alcohol wasn't more important than the relationship, right, then chances are I wouldn't have ran that to the ground. It wouldn't have died of alcoholism either. So what I see is that identifying my lack of control in my story becomes really important in seeing the idea that the consequences that I see in my life would have been much different if I was controlling alcohol. Right? But the way my story looks, I see that the situations in my life were a result of the lack of control in my life. So the conclusion is that I couldn't have lived any differently. I couldn't have drank any differently. And when I started, I lost control in spite of the consequences. So what becomes really useful, and I know we're kind of skipping over things, but we don't have
luxury of time.
Time, yeah. So what becomes really important is Bill's story. And how I use Bill's story in step one is to, in the first half of Bill's story, I use it as a tool to identify and relate my alcoholic life to Bill's life. So I go through the first 8 pages of Bill's story, underlining what I relate to, how Bill felt and how he drank. In fact, there's some instructions for that. If you look back,
the thing I looked at this was to look at the similarities rather than the differences in Bill's story. I was to look at how he felt, thought, and drank in the first 8 pages. And I need to look at an example of what an alcoholic is, and they felt that Bill's story was the perfect story because of, you know, it was just a pure alcoholic, how that goes. Did you find it?
Yeah. On XII, at the bottom half of the last paragraph, actually this is a third edition. The fourth edition, it's going to be a little different. It's probably the same, yeah. It says, if you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 44 personal stories. In the fourth edition, it's 42 personal stories. And think, yes, that happened to me. Or more important, yes, I felt like that. Right? Or most important, and what we look at in the second half of Bill's story, is yes, I believe this program can work for me too. So in the second half of Bill's story, I underline what Bill did to recover that I'm not willing to do.
And I think that's really important to look at what I'm not willing to do and be honest about that. You know, hell no, I don't want to make amends. You know, and there's a real freedom and structure because, like I said before, that any time a drunk sees a piece of truth, that's a spiritual experience, and you start having these spiritual experiences right from the gate, and it's really cool to recognize that.
So it's really useful to use Bill's story, as I said, as a tool to look at my own drinking. Setting aside the differences, I look for how I did the things that Bill's talking about, and I kind of try to align it time-wise, in a timeline kind of way, making notes in the margins of how I relate to it, and also realizing that he doesn't get sober till around page 9. So, as I said, setting aside the differences, like it says, war fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes. I wasn't in the service when all this started for me. I was in a gas station at Culver City. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with interviews hilarious. I was a part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. Right? All of a sudden, when I started hanging around this gas station, I had all these friends. They were all smoking pot and drinking, and doing. This was this is actually 1969, and there were still hippies at the time, and all this stuff was going on. None of it was anything that was interesting me at all, because I had my little group of friends now, and we just basically partied every day, doing the things that kids do. You know, we wait outside liquor stores waiting for someone to go in and buy us booze, But I can really relate to feeling I was a part of life at last. I thought that I could live that way forever. Right? You can relate to that.
Right.
It says, I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudice of my people concerning drink. There was plenty of warnings that I got from police, family. There was a lot of situations that happened around if it was in a different time or if I was in a different place, I would have seen that. But at the time, I thought I was invincible and that none of that was going to hurt me. Right? So the point here is that I set aside the differences that Bill has with my story, and I try to align my own story with that as I go through it.
Yeah, it's real important. Like Dan and I have two completely different stories. You know, he actually had an apartment, and I was living on the street. I ran away from home when I was 14, and I was living on the streets in a teepee in Topanga, and I was hanging out with the hippies, and my first drink was around a campfire. I had grown up in institutions and foster homes, and when I got back to my father, I just couldn't stand his way of life, so at 14 I ran away from home. And I lived in this teepee, and we had this big fire, and there was a group of us, and they were passing around a gallon of Red Mountain wine, and it came to me, and it had that hook in the, and I took my first drink, and I had arrived at that moment. I mean, there was all kinds of other things, like people were smoking pot and all this other stuff, but boy, that alcohol, it made me feel like, I guess you could describe it as the ninth step promises. If you look at the ninth step, the feeling of a fear of people left me and economic insecurity. I had arrived.
So one of the things that I found by attaching my experience to Bill's and how it aligned with it and how most people can relate to it is things started off real well. And for a time, I thought I was keeping things together. And as you go through the first half of Bill's story, you know, life gets better and better and better, and alcohol increased in his life. And I could see how that happened in mine. As my life progressed, so did my alcoholism. And I kept it together for a while, and then things started happening in my life that, as a result of the alcohol, that did cause problems. But I never turned away from alcohol, right, not at first. But as you started to hit the other side of that arch and things started to get worse, alcohol became a bigger part of my life. The struggle in my life, it got harder and harder to keep my life together and drink the way that I was drinking. And I see just like Bill, I got to this place where the consequences from drinking in my life was too obvious. And I tried multiple times to stop repeatedly and failed. And and that's what finally led me into the place where I saw that I needed help. Is that it wasn't that I didn't just wake up and decide I wanted to join a club. My life started to get so impacted by the way I was living and drinking that I got to a place of hopelessness. And desperation that I was willing to do whatever it took. I just didn't know what it was going to take. Right? And I drank for the last 2 years, absolutely knowing that I didn't want to continue to drink like that and didn't know how I was going to stop.
And that's what I relate to Dan's story is that he couldn't stop. You know, it wasn't that I lived on the streets why I was an alcoholic. I thought the drama of all of my drinking was based on, you know, why I'm an alcoholic. I was poster child, homeless, eating out of dumpsters, panhandling. And then all of a sudden I met Dan and I met my sponsor. He never had ever gone hungry before in his life. But what made him an alcoholic and me an alcoholic is once I started, I couldn't stop. And, you know, it starts to stay on the top of There's a Solution in Chapter 2. We have Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. So now I'm starting to look at how I relate to Bill's story versus the drama of his story, stock market, failed, you know, all of the things that he talked about. So now we're going to start to take that drama off of the drink and start looking at the allergy itself. So I look at myself, am I hopeless as Bill? Nearly all were once as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. Another promise. I call this the allergy promise. It's like, this is the promise that I can recover from this physical craving.
So on the bottom of page 20, we're going to talk about three types of drinkers. It talks about the moderate drinker having little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. When I look at my drinking, I can see that that wasn't me. I obviously can't relate to having little trouble in giving liquor up entirely if I had good reason for it. And I couldn't take it or leave it alone. And it says we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time, but if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, a change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate. That wasn't me. I drank like a hard drinker, but I couldn't stop, no matter what happened in my life. I couldn't stop or moderate. I had plenty of sufficient reasons to stop, but the depth of my powerlessness wasn't necessarily in how much I drank, but how hard I tried to stop. That gets a little difficult for some people, because some people get to Alcoholics Anonymous having been stopped by some situation. Work says, you know, you're done if you don't get some help. They go into a program and they learn about alcoholism and they say, yeah, I guess I need this. You know, or young people, there's a lot of young people now coming into the program. You know, they didn't have a marriage to lose, they didn't have a house to lose or a business to lose, right? But what they had was external situations that may have stopped them, right? So it gets a little more complicated for some of those people to relate to this book, because at the time when the book was written, these people were hopeless. There was no proof that AA was going to last as long as it was going to it has lasted, you know, and they had gone further down the scale than some of the people that are coming into AA now. Does that mean they're not alcoholic because they don't relate to some of this? Not necessarily. When you're working with people, you got to be really careful, because you don't want to be sending people out to kill themselves, right?
Right.
So,
sorry. Go ahead. Oh, yeah. Just to relate, because I've worked with people who weren't alcoholics. And I think the book helps us to sort that out, you know, and I've worked with a couple of people that got free of AA, they were hard drinkers. They were hard drinkers, and they looked just like alcoholics. They drink like an alcoholic. It tells me they might even die before their time. They need treatment. They need hospitalization. They look just like the alcoholic. But what you have to look for if you're working with somebody is, was a sufficient reason why they stopped drinking. And you can hear that if you listen to the people you're working with and you listen to what they say, you can hear it. You can hear the sufficient reason. And the two people I'm talking about were having very difficult times in AA for 10 years and found out that they weren't alcoholic, and we saw what their actual problem was. One was an Al-Anon. And she told me this story, and when we were going through this, what we're looking at now, she said that, I don't have the craving for alcohol, but I have that craving for alcoholics. And she said, going to a meeting was like an open bar for a drunk. And then then I could relate to what she was talking about. So that's a sufficient reason. She had a sufficient reason to stop drinking.
So some people get a little panicked when we start to talk about that.
Mm.
Right. But you got to understand that this is something that becomes really important. Finding out what's true for you, for yourself, becomes really important. It's not about weeding non-alcoholics out of AA. That's not what we're talking about.
Right.
This is about finding out what is my desperation, what is my personal experience with hopelessness that is sufficient enough to drive me towards a spiritual experience and needing a solution that only God in my life is going to fix. Right? So you can't start a spiritual process with a lie. Right? And it's not about so much, you know, which meetings you're allowed to go to or what you know. If you're in the first step, it's about being honest with yourself as far as is what do I need an act of God to save me from? And that's why this becomes important. It's because, again, I mentioned it in the beginning when we were looking at the forewords, you know, when Bill brought Dr. Bob the description of alcoholism from Dr. Silkworth, it was only then he could pursue the spiritual remedy that he had already been doing that wasn't keeping him sober prior to that. It was when he really understood what was wrong with him, he was able to pursue the spiritual remedy like his life depended on it. Right? And that's really what the point here is if I can be honest with myself about what's wrong with me. Because, this is not about non-alcoholics. This is about real alcoholics that don't believe they're a real alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it goes on to say, but what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. I did. And he may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. Right? But I did. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. You see, one of the things that I was guilty of, this is when I got here, is I didn't believe I was as bad as you people.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that I was going to figure out what's really happening here because I certainly didn't want a God in my life because I'd lost everything important to me. So I certainly had believed that there was something else going on here. And what I had to see was that I think what this is about is showing real alcoholics that they're real alcoholics. That's really what this book is about. Because I have to proceed from step one knowing what's wrong with me, whatever that is, right? Because that's what's going to lead me into step two, needing power.
Yeah, I think this sentence is really, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control, complete loss of control. And I think that's a really kind of separates the hard drinker from the real alcoholic, is losing all control. And the difference with the hard drinker is he doesn't lose all control. His wife said, "You better stop drinking," and he does. You know, so like Dan said, we're not trying to weed out, but the important thing is that you find the truth about what your true problem is, because this is a truth-facing process, and you can't go through a truth-facing process based on a lie. And I did that. I had experience with that. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous through Cocaine Anonymous, and I was not an addict. I was a hard user, and I really died in CA, and I ended up, like I said, a suicide attempt, and after a long period of. So the truth is important. I'm really passionate about that, because I wasn't shown how to find my own truth out of this book, like we're talking about. So this is a gift, I think, to be able to share my experience with that with you, and so that you wouldn't have to go through what I went through, damn near dying. going through this process based on a lie.
So hopefully, as I've gone through this, I've attached my experience to it to get to this point on the bottom of 22 and 23 where it says, where the consideration is, does my experience abundantly confirm that once I put any alcohol in my system, I lose control. From that point, if I've seen that my life is an example of lack of control, right, physically. It goes on to say on 23, it says, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So remember I said that it's going to, as it switches into the next section, it's going to pose a consideration that we need to see. One of the things that I see about this section here is people will latch on to the idea that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. What you got to understand is we're still at the beginning of the book. Up to this point, the main problem that they're going to start to have us look at is in my mind, right? And it says it centers in his mind. So there's more. That's not my only problem. It's just a big one.
Yeah, that's why it's academic and pointless. You know, if the man never took the first drink. So how do I take the first drink? I have to think about it. I have to make a decision in my mind to pick up a drink. And sometimes they're oh, go ahead. I lost my train of thought.
Okay. On 24 it says, the fact is that most alcoholics are even yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink, or so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. So one of the things that, so what I got to see is that I have lost the power of choice in whether or not I was going to drink. It says, or so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Oh, here's the problem. We're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation. We've discussed this. If you look up the definition of certain, it's definite times. It's inescapable. It's at definite times. I was unable to bring into the consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the consequences that I continually had. In other words, those things didn't stop me from drinking. I'd wake up, get up, walk to the liquor store to buy more alcohol. And after 1987, after I had come to the conclusion that I didn't want to drink anymore, right? I was walking to the liquor store knowing that I didn't want to drink anymore, right? The consequences didn't come into my mind sufficient enough to stop me. It got to the point where I was baffled by by the way I was existing. I'd talk to myself out loud on the way to the liquor store, yelling at myself.
No Bluetooth.
Right. This was before Bluetooth. See, it meant something different back then when someone was walking down the street talking to themselves. Today you just assume they're on the phone. You wouldn't know they're crazy. But I was certainly insane. You know, one of the definitions of insanity that you hear in meetings is insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. If you think about it, as long as I expected different results, I had hope. Right? I had got to the place where I was doing the same thing over and over again, knowing I couldn't stop, knowing I was trapped in a condition that had me confused. I knew I was crazy. I knew there was something wrong, and I didn't know how to get out of it. Sometimes the consequences came into my mind. Sometimes they didn't. Either way, the consequences were never enough to stop me once I got it into my mind. And an obsession, this second part of step one, this obsession is what continually took me back to buy more liquor, and I started to drink, and I wasn't drinking one drink, right? I would just continue to drink until whatever stopped me.
Yeah, so my experience with this, I'm 3 years sober. I've done some book work. It wasn't as outlined in the book. I did a lot of recovery dynamics with Joe and Charlie. And 3 years sober, I was doing a chalk talk with 170 guys downtown L.A. at Towns and Fifth. And there's homeless people laying in the streets, and that's what happens to me when I drink. I end up homeless. And so my life was miserable. I was punching holes in walls, yelling at my girlfriend, breaking tables. I was totally insane, you know. And I was a drunk, 3 years dry, without a solution. And nobody showed me the solution at that time. So what's important is that I walked out of that chalk talk doing the first three steps knowing exactly what's going to happen to me if I take a drink, and I convinced myself it would be okay. I convinced myself it would be okay. Then when I made that ultimate decision, I decided I'm not going to go through that. I'm going to kill myself. So I got a gun, tried to shoot myself, and I couldn't do it. And I said, I know what will help me pull the trigger. A 40. So I went and got me a 40, ended up selling the gun for more booze. So I couldn't bring into mind sufficient force of what was going to happen.
So it says at 37, there's always the curious mental phenomena that parallel with our sound reasoning. There inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink, or sound reasoning failed to hold us in check, and the insane idea won out. And next day we'd ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how it could have happened. I lived that way for years, just completely baffled by that existence. You know, from 23 to 43, my focus is looking at the insanity of the obsession and how the it was obvious to me that I was insane. I even sought help from a therapist. Therapists can be really good, but they need to be familiar with alcohol and drug situations. Not every, even though therapists will specialize in everything, if you look at their advertisements, it's the person that I went to didn't refer me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and ultimately didn't get me anywhere. So in other words, I'm not saying therapy is bad. I think being directed towards someone who's familiar with what has worked for alcoholics is better. So again, we're skipping over stuff because we're short of time, but let's just summarize that and go on to the next. Is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So, as I said, at the end of each section, there's a summary. And at the bottom of 43, at the end of the mental part, or the part that we look at the mental part of the problem, it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times, right, definite times, has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human can provide such defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So that was clear to me, that it's at definite times there was no mental defense against the first drink. Again, I over and over again, I was walking to the liquor store to buy booze, knowing that I didn't want to drink anymore.
So this takes away the choice. I've lost my choice. If I've lost control and I've lost, if I've lost choice and I've lost control, then I'm going to need something more to change my mind. And because of what we're going to look at next, the fact is that I'm separated from God at this point. I've lost all control and all choice. So you hear people in meetings, I chose not to drink today. And it's like, I've lost all choice in drink. And I think it's really important for me to look and see that truth, that piece of truth, that I can't choose to get out of drinking. 3 years sober. And the thought came that drink would be better than being sober. And going ahead and ending up homeless right then and there. I did. I sold my car, the gun. I sold everything because I made a choice that I had no choice. I didn't have any other choice but to drink because of what was happening with me, with my separation from God. Right?
So at the end of the second section, the obsession, and going into the third part of step one, the unmanageability. I look at the unmanageability on page 44, 45, and 52. It makes a statement here on 44, but after a while we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. So the consideration is, why is it that if I've been free of the obsession to drink, obsession is not just the thought of drinking, the obsession is that thought of drinking that drives you to more drinking, in spite of you not wanting to drink again, right? The obsession, an obsession is the idea that overrides your logic that's stronger than what you. The obsession is the thought that overrides the rationality.
Right, it overrules any other thought.
Yeah. So the idea that we had to find a spiritual basis of life or else, that's sort of a hard concept. But the question is, why is it that if I'm free from the obsession for any length of time, what is it that causes the obsession to come back? Right? That would be important to know, right? Because that would be true from somebody with 30 days or 60 days or 90 days.
3 years.
3 years. 30 years. Right? You know, time does not save me from this condition that we're talking about. What is it that sets up the condition conducive for the obsessions to return? Right, that becomes important to all of us. So there's some really good questions that we look at it on page 52. In the middle of page 52, it says we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. That's as we did with alcohol, right? up to this point, now we've looked at alcoholism inside of us, not out here, right? The mental obsession and the physical craving, right? So hopefully we've changed your point of view, because it's no longer I drank because of her and I drank because of work and I drank because I see I have this obsession, I see I have this craving.
Yeah, I'm not a situational drinker. I didn't drink over anything. I drank because I had an obsession.
Yeah. You know, you hear people say that I drank because of my feelings. Fact is that I drank when she left me, and I drank when she came back.
I drank when I had the job, and I drank when I lost the job.
I drank when the team lost, and I drank when the team won. Right? See, how I felt didn't necessarily affect the way I was drinking. I drank either way. Right? Because if it was about feelings, you'd see a difference, you know, in the way that you drank.
The feelings lie. The feelings lie.
What I have to see here is that underneath the obsession was this unmanageability of my spiritual condition. It goes on to say, we were having trouble with personal relationships. I certainly was. I had the marriage that died of alcoholism. I had people around me that I disconnected with because of the way I was living. I even had employees that were quite upset with me because eventually they didn't have a job anymore. when the work caved in, I had a lot of trouble with personal relationships. It's just we couldn't control our emotional natures. Any time the book refers to the nature of something, I believe it's what's inside, not what's outside. I could control my emotions. Now, what I showed you, the face that I showed you, I could control. What I couldn't control is my emotional nature, what was underneath, what was going on underneath the face that I was showing you. Right? That's what I couldn't control. And there was a lot of pain because by the time I got into this point here, I lost everything. It says we were prey to misery and depression. I certainly was. I had lost everything and didn't think I was ever going to get my old life back. What I learned later was I really didn't want my old life back.
I always like to look at that word prey. It's pretty drastic. You know, when a lion is after you, you're the prey. You know, it's chasing you. So depression was definitely chasing me, I was prey to it. I couldn't control it. I couldn't control my emotion. I was kicking the walls in. I was breaking. I couldn't control my emotional nature, and it was coming from within, like Dan said. And the great fact about it is that if I see that it's all inside of me. If the whole world has to change, which I thought before, and why I was drinking, if the whole world had to change to fit my little rules and things that I thought, then there's no hope in that. There's no hope. So when I start to see that it's in my mind and in my body, and that that's what has to change. That's what has to change.
Since we couldn't make a living, I obviously had a business that I couldn't keep going. But some people don't have that problem. They have businesses that they do keep up even through their drinking. And I think it goes a lot deeper than just making a living. Is I couldn't make a living sufficient enough to keep me happy or sober.
Right, I think making a living is that I'm okay with what I get, what I make. I'm okay with the amount of money that I get. I'm okay with the job I have. I'm okay with the people that I work with.
Making a life.
Right.
We had a feeling of uselessness. I certainly did. You know, by the time I got into the program, I was pretty sure that I had a pretty useless existence. Right? Because I had got to the point where I was basically living to drink for a long time. You know, Sheldon mentioned that he was on the streets and I was in an apartment. What he didn't mention was is that I was managing the building, okay? So nobody knew that I wasn't paying rent, that I couldn't afford to pay rent. So the feeling of uselessness, you know, even though I had a place to live, I mean, I was just surviving, right? Since we were full of fear, you know, I didn't realize to what extent my life, my whole existence was driven and steered by fear.
Another drastic word, full of fear. Not half fear, but full of fear.
And you'll see that more in your inventory.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were unhappy. I certainly was. I was sure that life would never be different for me. That things were going to stay bad, and the idea of being sober and staying sober was dismal. Right. So, couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. When I first read that, I wasn't too concerned with that because I didn't necessarily care about it.
Right.
So, but I'm sure that that means more to some people. So what I have to see is what this is outlining for me is a spiritual condition. I certainly relate to having problems with all of these at some point. And what I have to see here is that although these are pointing to the spiritual condition at the time, what I have to see is that this is not necessarily the spiritual malady, but a test to see what my spiritual condition is. And the reason I say that is that, later on, what I found was when I looked back at this, I didn't have this stuff. Right? I could see that I was moved to a different place. But sometimes it becomes a really good test later on because we can go back to it we could go back to it at some point and see how are we doing spiritually.
Right. It's like a checklist to take a look at where I stand.
Am I currently having problems with personal relationships? Am I currently having problems with my emotional nature? Right? Gives you an idea of where you're at. If there's any painters in here, you'll know. I don't see any pictures on the wall, but if you look at a picture of like a lake in a mountain setting, the way that the artist will paint the lake, if you look at the lake, the artist has painted the mountains and the trees and everything around the lake into the lake to illustrate the water, right? So basically these questions become the palette which I use to paint a picture of my spiritual condition, right? Am I currently having problems with personal relationships? Am I currently having problems with my emotional nature? Am I prey to misery and depression today? Right? So these are not the spiritual malady themselves, but considerations to look at what is going on inside.
And it's the separation from God. It's the malady of the spirit. There's periods of times when I go through the steps again, and I start looking at how am I separated from God, and not every one of these things might be, but something pops out. That means there's something I'm separated somewhere, because this is what the recovered from a physical and mental state. This is the mental state, and I can recover from this. And when these things start to pop up in my life, I might want to relook at my relationship with God and the people about me.
This becomes really important when you understand the progression. and that is I have to see. I remember I started this with the idea is why is it after 30 days or 90 days or 3 years or 30 years, what is it that sets up the condition conducive for the obsessions to return? Right. Well, this is it. The unmanageability of my life. When my life is unmanageable and I've fallen back into a poor spiritual condition, that is what sets up the condition conducive for the obsessions to return.
And what kind of manageability are you talking about? Like paying your rent?
No. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
So, you know, when I came in, they said the unmanageability of my life is like, well, I don't have a job, I can't pay rent, and I need these things, and that's what the manageability of my life is.
I don't go to the gym enough.
Right, still. But so what I had to start looking at is that it was about the unmanageability that they're talking about. A malady is a sickness, a separation, a sickness. So the malady of the spirit is a sickened spirit. I don't believe that the spirit is actually sick. I think it's a pure thing. But the sickened spirit that they're talking about is my separation from that. So I'm separated from the spirit, so therefore page 52 starts to manifest itself. So the manageability is my connection with God, my conscious contact with God, and that's what manages me spiritually, not to pay the rent and all of these other things that are outside of me. Remember, we're looking inside, the mind and the body, and now the spirit also is within.
So that becomes really important. To understand that if for long-term sobriety I have to have a way of life conducive for identifying that this separation of the spirit, and you'll see that a lot of what follows is just that, is exercises and through the process to identify spiritual separation, where we don't have God in our lives, and where we need to bring God into our lives, even all the way through to 10 and 11, right? Where we see current spiritual separation. So I have to be clear that the unmanageability in my life is what takes me to the obsession. And if I have this physical craving, once I start to drink, I lose control. Right. So with that, we're going to take a 10-minute bathroom break and start probably at 25 after.
We're also going to be recording today's the workshop today, so if you guys want to...